A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Hannah sent us this one, and it's the kind of question where the real answer is buried under about 6 layers of parenting anxiety, marketing nonsense, and decades of contradictory studies. She's asking 2 things. First, how bad is it really to show TV or movies to Ezra, who's about to turn 1, not as a babysitter, just for occasional mild entertainment? And second, she's been hearing from parenting circles that modern kids' shows are wildly overstimulating compared to the calmer stuff from the 90s. Mr. Rogers, Barney, Wishbone, and that the new shows leave kids dysregulated. Is there actual evidence for that, or is this just nostalgia with a side of moral panic?
This is exactly the kind of question where I want to start by pulling apart what the official guidance actually says, because most people cite it without having read it. The American Academy of Pediatrics recommendation, the one everyone quotes, says no screen time at all for children under 18 months, with one specific exception. FaceTime with grandma, Zoom with the cousins. Which is fascinating because it means the AAP isn't saying screens are inherently toxic. They're saying certain kinds of screen-mediated interaction don't work the same way for an infant brain.
The official line is 0 screens, except the one kind of screen time that makes everyone in the family equally miserable in different ways.
That's the clinical summary, yes. But here's what gets left out of the parenting blog version. The 18-month cutoff isn't based on direct evidence of harm from occasional exposure. It's based on what we know about what babies aren't getting when they're watching a screen. The core issue is displacement.
Displacement of what?
Specifically, live language from a real human who's responding to the baby in real time. There's a body of work on this. Patricia Kuhl's lab at the University of Washington did the foundational studies. They exposed 9-month-olds to Mandarin Chinese. One group got live interaction with a native speaker. Another group got the exact same speaker on video. The live group learned to discriminate Mandarin phonemes. The video group? Statistically indistinguishable from 0 exposure.
The screen isn't poisoning anything. The baby just isn't learning from it.
And that's the through line for pretty much all the research that's worth taking seriously. It's not that screens cause damage directly. It's that time spent watching a screen is time not spent in contingent social interaction. The kind where the adult responds to what the baby is looking at, follows their gaze, labels objects, adjusts tone. That's the engine of language development in the first 2 years.
Which means the question isn't really, how bad is the screen? It's what is the screen replacing?
That's the better framing. And it's why the occasional fussy baby video isn't the thing anyone should lose sleep over. The problem case is the household where the TV is on 6 hours a day in the background. There's a fairly well-cited 2009 study by Tomopoulos and colleagues that found background television reduced parent-child interaction by about 20%, fewer words spoken, fewer conversational turns, shorter joint attention episodes. That's the mechanism.
Hannah's very occasionally when he's fussy. I mean, the clinical answer is still not recommended, but the actual risk profile is basically nil.
With the caveat that we're talking about a few minutes here and there, not an hour every evening. There's a large longitudinal study out of Japan, published in JAMA Pediatrics in 2023. They followed over 7,000 children and found a dose-response relationship between screen time at age 1 and communication delays at ages 2 and 4. But the association really kicked in around 2 hours per day and above. At 1 hour, the effect was modest.
Modest meaning clinically detectable, but not necessarily meaningful at the individual level.
And here's something most coverage misses. That study couldn't fully control for what they call maternal educational attainment and household income. The families with more screen time also tended to have fewer books in the home, less time reading aloud. So the screen time might be a marker, not a cause.
The confound of confounds.
And there's another angle people don't talk about enough, the effect on the parent. If you're a parent with an 11-month-old and you're completely fried, and 10 minutes of a video lets you reset and be more present afterward, the net effect on the child might actually be positive. Nobody randomizes that study because you can't, but clinically, as a former pediatrician, that's real.
The honest answer to Hannah's first question is, the official guidance says, wait, but the occasional video isn't going to break anything, and the thing to actually watch out for is what the screen is crowding out, not the screen itself.
That's it. And I'll add one thing, there's a specific developmental window here. Ezra's approaching 12 months. This is when joint attention really crystallizes, pointing, gaze following, the back and forth of, look at that dog, and the baby looking where you're looking. That's the infrastructure for language. So if you're going to be thoughtful about screens, this is actually the right moment to be asking the question. Not because it's the most dangerous window, but because it's the one where the alternative activity, shared attention, is doing the heaviest lifting.
Alright, so let me pivot to the second half of Hannah's question, because I think this is where things get genuinely interesting, and also where the discourse gets completely unmoored from evidence. Modern kids shows, overstimulating, rapid cuts, bright colors, old shows, calm, slow, better for the child's nervous system. Is there any actual research behind this, or is this just the Cocoa Puffs of parenting opinions?
First, let's name what people are actually talking about when they say modern overstimulating shows. The poster child for this is Cocomelon.
Of course it is.
Cocomelon is the most watched preschool show on the planet, billions of views on YouTube. And it has a very specific production style. The average shot length is about 2 to 3 seconds. The camera is almost never static. There's a constant slow zoom or pan in every shot. The color palette is extremely saturated. Characters are always moving. There's almost no negative space visually.
It's the Michael Bay of nursery rhymes.
I was going to say it's visual dopamine, but Michael Bay of nursery rhymes is better. Now, is there peer-reviewed research specifically on Cocomelon and attention or regulation? There's one small study from 2022 that got a lot of media pickup. It looked at about 60 children, compared Cocomelon to a slower-paced show, and reported more subsequent attentional difficulties in the Cocomelon group. But the sample was tiny, the effect sizes were modest, and it hasn't been replicated at scale.
The thing everyone on Instagram is absolutely certain about rests on one unreplicated study of 60 kids.
Welcome to parenting discourse. But here's where it gets more nuanced. The broader question about pacing in children's cognition has been studied for decades. It's not new. The foundational work goes back to the 1970s with Sesame Street.
Wait, Sesame Street was the original Too Fast show?
It absolutely was. When Sesame Street launched in 1969, it was criticized for exactly the same things people now say about Cocomelon. Fast cuts, jazzy editing, too stimulating. The concern was that it would shorten children's attention spans.
The panic is a circle.
The panic is a perfect circle. But the research on Sesame Street actually showed the opposite. It improved school readiness, particularly for low-income children. The key difference, I think, is that Sesame Street was designed with developmental psychologists in the room. The pacing was fast, but the content was structured around educational goals. The fast cut served the learning, not just retention.
Pace alone isn't the variable. It's pace plus content structure.
And this is where the old shows are better. Claim needs more precision. When people say Mr. Rogers is calmer and better, they're conflating two things. Rogers is slower paced, yes, average shot length around 8 to 10 seconds, long conversational segments, lots of quiet moments. But it's not just the pace, it's the whole interactional style. Fred Rogers talks directly to the child, pauses as if waiting for a response, models emotional language, visits real places at a real pace. That's not just slower, that's a fundamentally different theory of what television should do.
He's doing contingent interaction through a screen, which circles back to the video call exception.
And Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood was developed with child psychologist Margaret McFarland. The slowness wasn't an aesthetic choice, it was a developmental one. They believe the television should approximate the pace of real interaction. And there is some evidence this matters. A 2011 study by Lillard and Peterson randomly assigned 4-year-olds to watch either a fast-paced cartoon, it was SpongeBob actually, or a slower-paced educational show, or to draw. After just 9 minutes, the SpongeBob group performed worse on executive function tasks. That study was published in Pediatrics, and it got enormous attention. But it had critics. The sample was small, and some argued the effect was about the fantastical content, not the pace. SpongeBob has characters transforming physically, violating physics. That kind of content might tax executive function differently than realistic scenarios.
We don't even know if it's the speed or the surrealism.
We don't. And that's the honest answer. The research hasn't cleanly separated pacing, fantastical content, color saturation, and interactivity. They tend to travel together in modern shows. When people say their kid is dysregulated after Cocomelon but calm after Mr. Rogers, I don't doubt their experience. But we can't say with confidence which variable is doing the work.
There's another layer here, which is that the parent's own state matters. If you believe the modern show is overstimulating, you're watching your kid differently. Confirmation bias is not a parenting failure, it's just how human perception works.
If you've been told by your parenting group that Cocomelon makes kids wild, you're going to notice every instance of post-Cocomelon wildness and discount the times they're calm. This is not to dismiss parental intuition, it's to say that intuition is a hypothesis, not a finding.
Let me try to synthesize what we actually know about the old versus new question. There is some evidence that very fast-paced, fantastical content can temporarily reduce executive function in young children. There's a plausible mechanism around cognitive depletion. The brain working hard to process rapid scene changes leaves fewer resources for self-regulation afterward. But the effect is short-term, it's not clear whether it accumulates, and the research hasn't isolated the specific features that drive it. Meanwhile, slower-paced, reality-grounded, interactively styled shows like Mr. Rogers have a better theoretical basis and some supporting evidence, but not a massive body of head-to-head trials.
That's a fair summary. I'd add one more piece. There's a concept in developmental media research called the video deficit effect. It's the finding that children under about 2.5 learn significantly less from video than from equivalent live demonstrations. This effect is robust. It's been replicated dozens of times. But the video deficit can be reduced. When the video includes interactive elements, when the character appears to respond contingently, when the content is repeated, the gap shrinks.
The video deficit is not a law of nature. It's a design problem.
That's exactly how I put it. And it means the question isn't old versus new. It's, does the show approximate contingent social interaction, or does it just hold attention through sensory bombardment?
Which gives us an actual heuristic. Does the character talk to the child as if expecting a response? Are there pauses? Is the visual pacing slow enough that a real person could plausibly move that way? If yes, it's probably fine. If no, it's sensory candy.
Sensory candy is a good term. And I should mention, there is some work specifically on the sensory bombardment concern. A 2022 review in Frontiers in Psychology looked at the perceptual features of popular YouTube content for young children and found that many of the most viewed videos used what they called saliency-driven design, high contrast, rapid motion, frequent scene changes, intense colors. The concern these researchers raised wasn't about direct damage, but about the possibility that this kind of content sets a sensory baseline that makes real-world interaction feel understimulating by comparison.
Like eating tacos and then being disappointed by an apple.
That's actually a shockingly good analogy. The apple hasn't changed. Your palate has.
The concern is that Cocomelon is straining a preference for Cocomelon-level stimulation, and then the living room feels boring.
That's the hypothesis. It's plausible, it hasn't been proven longitudinally, and it's very hard to study because you can't randomly assign kids to a high-stimulation media diet for years.
Right, ethics boards tend to frown on. We'd like to potentially mess up your child's attention span for science.
They're sticklers about that. So instead, we get cross-sectional studies and parental surveys, and those are suggestive but not definitive. One 2023 study out of the UK, published in the Journal of Child Psychology and Psychiatry, found that high levels of screen use in infancy, and I'm talking more than 3 hours a day, were associated with sensory processing differences at 33 months. Things like being underwhelmed by typical sensory input or seeking intense sensory experiences.
Again, 3 hours a day. That's not occasional video when fussy.
And that's the recurring problem in translating this research to actual parenting. The studies that find effects are almost always studying doses far higher than what most thoughtful parents are doing. The low-dose research is mostly null.
We've got a research literature that's very good at telling us what happens at the extremes and very bad at giving precise guidance for the middle.
That's the state of the field. And it's why the AAP plays it safe with none under 18 months. It's simpler to say none than to say, well, it depends on the content, the context, the dose, your child's temperament, what else you're doing that day, and whether Mercury is in retrograde.
Mercury in retrograde is actually the only variable with consistent effect sizes.
Don't start.
Let me pull on something you said earlier about the parent reset. I think there's an under-discussed angle here about what screens do for the parent-child system, not just the child in isolation. If Hannah or Daniel is alone with Ezra all day, and the choice at 4 p.m. is between a 10-minute video and a parent who's losing their patience, I know which one I'd pick.
This is where pediatric guidance often fails parents. It treats the parent as a pure execution engine for optimal child development, rather than as a human with limits. I saw this in practice all the time. The families who were most anxious about screens were often the ones with the least to worry about because the anxiety itself reflected how much they were already doing right.
The parenting version of, if you're worried about being a narcissist, you're probably not one.
The parents who should be worried are the ones not asking the question at all. And Hannah's asking the question with a lot of nuance. Not, can I park him in front of the TV for hours? But what's the actual risk of occasional entertainment?
Let me try to give a direct answer to the first question, since Hannah actually deserves one. For an 11-month-old, occasional short videos, we're talking a few minutes, not a full episode of something, are not supported by pediatric guidelines, but the evidence for harm at that dose is essentially non-existent. The risk is displacement of language-rich interaction. If the video is replacing a tantrum, not replacing a conversation, the calculus changes. And the AAP's own exception for video calls tells you that the concern is about the quality of the interaction, not the photons hitting the retina.
I'd sign off on that, and I'd add, if you're going to do it, treat it like dessert, not a food group. After age 18 months, the guidance shifts. The AAP says high-quality programming is fine, with a parent watching alongside to help the child understand what they're seeing. So the window Hannah's in right now is the most restrictive one, and it's only got about 6 months left.
That's actually a helpful framing. This isn't forever, it's the home stretch of the no screens window.
And by the way, the co-viewing recommendation, watching together, that's not just hand-holding. There's good evidence that co-viewing dramatically changes what children get from media. When a parent narrates, points, asks questions, the video deficit shrinks substantially.
The same show can be junk food or reasonably nutritious depending on whether a parent is on the couch engaging with it.
Which is why blanket statements about this show is bad miss the point. The show is one variable in a system.
All right, let's tackle the old versus new question head on. If Hannah's deciding between showing Ezra something from her own childhood, Barney, Wishbone, Mr. Well, Rogers, versus something contemporary like Cocomelon, is there a defensible case for the older stuff?
There's a theoretical case and a weak empirical case. The theoretical case is what we've been describing. Older shows, particularly public television shows from the pre-cable era, were designed in an environment where educational value was the explicit justification for children's television. The funding structures were different. Fred Rogers was testifying before Congress to secure PBS funding. The whole enterprise was built around a developmental mission.
Whereas Cocomelon is built around YouTube's recommendation algorithm.
That's the critique. Cocomelon is optimized for autoplay and retention. The color palette, the constant motion, the 3-second shot length, these aren't accidents. They're features that maximize watch time. And the company has been fairly transparent that they use A/B testing on children's attention. They show different versions and see which one keeps eyes on the screen longer.
It's not designed to be good for children. It's designed to be good at keeping children.
That's the distinction. And I think that's what parents are sensing when they say it feels different. They're not imagining it. The design philosophy is fundamentally different. Whether that translates to measurable harm is a separate question, but the intuition isn't baseless.
That said, I want to push back on the nostalgia filter a bit. Barney was not exactly high art.
Barney was widely mocked in its own time for being saccharine and repetitive, and it had its own critics who said it was overstimulating. The I Love You, You Love Me song was considered a form of psychological warfare by many parents.
I'm not saying they were right, but I understand their position.
The point is, every generation thinks the new stuff is too much and the old stuff was just right. That doesn't mean the concern is always wrong. It means we need evidence to sort out which panics were justified.
In this case,
I think the concern about pacing and sensory overload has some grounding. Not enough to say, never show modern shows, but enough to say, be selective. The slower-paced, more interactive stuff, old or new, has a stronger theoretical basis, and there are contemporary shows that follow that model. Bluey, for instance, has a much more restrained visual style and narrative pacing. Daniel Tiger's Neighborhood is literally the animated descendant of Mr. Rogers, using the same social-emotional curriculum.
It's not that all new shows are Cocomelon. It's that Cocomelon is the most visible example of a design philosophy that prioritizes attention capture over developmental appropriateness.
And I'd go further. The real issue isn't old versus new. It's algorithm-optimized versus developmentally designed. Those are the actual categories, and they don't map neatly onto decade.
That's the kind of reframe that makes me want to throw out the whole framing of Hannah's question and start over.
Her question is, what people are actually asking in parenting groups, and I think it's worth answering on its own terms first, then offering the better framework.
So, on its own terms, is there evidence that modern kids' shows are more overstimulating than 90s shows? There's evidence that the most popular modern shows use faster pacing and more intense sensory features. There's weak evidence that this can temporarily affect attention and regulation. But there isn't a large body of research directly comparing old and new shows head-to-head on behavioral outcomes. The strongest case for older shows is theoretical, not empirical. It's about the design philosophy, not a proven harm.
I'd add one thing I haven't seen discussed much. When we talk about 90s shows, we're talking about a handful of programs that survived in cultural memory because they were good. We're not comparing the average 90s show to the average modern show. We're comparing the best of the 90s to the median of today.
Nobody's in the parenting group saying we only let our kids watch the forgotten direct-to-video knockoffs from 1993.
The comparison is Mr. Rogers versus Cocomelon. But the fairer comparison might be Mr. Rogers versus Daniel Tiger, or some forgotten 90s schlock versus Bluey.
All right, let me try to pull this into something actionable. If I'm Hannah, I want a decision rule, not a literature review.
That's what I do. Here's my shot at it. For a child under 18 months, the official guidance is no screens except video calls. The actual risk of occasional brief use is very low, especially if it's not displacing interaction. For content selection, the features that matter are pace, interactivity, and realism. Slower is better. Characters who talk to the child are better. Real-world scenarios are better than fantastical ones, and co-viewing transforms the experience.
If you're choosing between showing something or not showing anything, the question to ask is, what would my child be doing instead? If the answer is screaming inconsolably while I try to make dinner, the screen might be the better option. If the answer is, looking at a book with me, it's not.
That's the displacement test. It's not a formal clinical tool, but it captures the actual mechanism that the research cares about.
One more thing I want to name. There's a class dynamic in this conversation that makes me uncomfortable. The parents who have the time and bandwidth to curate low-stimulation media diets and co-view everything and feel guilty about Cocomelon. Those parents tend to have resources. The families where the TV is on all day are often families where the parents are working multiple jobs or facing other stresses. The screen time isn't a parenting philosophy, it's a coping strategy.
This is a crucial point, and it's one the research community doesn't handle well. The studies control for socioeconomic status, but the recommendations that come out of them. Just co-view everything. Assume a parent with leisure time. It's not a coincidence that the most intensive parenting norms emerge from affluent communities.
Then those norms filter down through Instagram and become another way for parents to feel inadequate.
And I want to be clear, when I say the evidence supports slower-paced co-viewed content, I'm describing an ideal, not a moral obligation. Parents who can't do that aren't harming their children. They're living in the real world.
For Hannah, who is asking from a place of genuine curiosity and clearly has the bandwidth to be thoughtful about this, the advice can be more specific. But the broader conversation should come with a humility that the research often lacks.
Let me throw in one more empirical nugget that might be useful. There's a 2020 study from the University of Calgary that looked at screen time and behavior problems during the pandemic. They found that the quality of parent-child interaction was a much stronger predictor of outcomes than screen time itself. Kids who had warm, responsive parents did fine regardless of screen time. Kids who didn't struggled regardless of screen time.
The screen is a bit player. The relationship is the lead.
And that's actually the most reassuring finding in the whole literature. If you're showing up as a parent, really showing up, attuned and responsive, the occasional video is noise in the signal.
Which brings us back to something you said at the beginning. The parent who uses 10 minutes of video to reset and then be more present, that's not a failure of parenting. That's a regulation strategy for the whole system.
The parent's nervous system is part of the child's environment. Regulating yourself regulates your child.
This has been surprisingly reassuring for a conversation about screen time guidelines.
I think that's because we actually walk through the evidence instead of just repeating the headlines. The headlines are designed to scare you. The data, read carefully, is mostly about dose and displacement.
All right, before we wrap, I want to give Hannah the concrete answer she asked for. Ezra, almost one. Occasional mild entertainment on a screen? What's the actual risk?
The risk of occasional brief exposure, a few minutes here and there, is negligible. The AAP says wait until 18 months. The evidence for harm at low doses is thin to non-existent. The main thing to protect is the time you spend talking, reading, and interacting. If the screen isn't eating into that, you're fine.
On the old versus new question, the older shows like Mr. Rogers and Wishbone were built on a developmental model that has some theoretical advantages. Slower pacing, more contingent interaction, less sensory bombardment. There's no large body of research proving modern shows cause dysregulation, but the design philosophy behind the most popular current shows, algorithm optimized for attention, retention, is fundamentally different from the educational mission behind the classics. The smarter filter isn't old versus new. It's design for children's development versus design for watch time.
If you want specific recommendations, Mr. Rogers is still out there. Daniel Tiger is its modern descendant and is excellent. Bluey is beautifully paced and emotionally sophisticated. Even old Sesame Street holds up. You don't have to be a media archaeologist to find good stuff.
The fact that you just use media archaeologist unironically is why I keep you around.
I contain multitudes.
Now, Hilbert's Daily Fun Fact.
In the 1860s, Mongolian herdsmen reported that their livestock developed a peculiar blue-green tint to their wool after grazing on a mineral-rich lichen found only on north-facing slopes of the Altai Mountains. The color, later traced to copper compounds in the lichen, was briefly fashionable in Russian textile markets before synthetic dyes made it obsolete. No one ever figured out why only north-facing slopes.
Of course it is.
I do wonder what the sheep thought about all this.
The sheep were fashionable, and they knew it.
This has been My Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer Hilbert Flumingtop for keeping this operation running. If you enjoyed this episode, leave us a review wherever you listen. It helps other people find the show.
We're at myweirdprompts.com, and we'll be back with another one soon.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.